Senator Solon, you have the first bill on today's agenda, Senate File 1354. I think all of these are going to require some dollars. So if we approve today the philosophy and the of the bills, and we'll send them on to the Money Committee for their review and for their funding, hopefully. So Senate File 1354, Senator Solon. Senator Solon, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'd so move that bill, Chairman.
That's the way to do it.
Thank you.
All in favor?
Okay.
All right. Senator Sharon, yours is going to go that fast, too. Yeah. Okay, you get a little compromise. We'll give you 3.5 minutes.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Take what you need.
Thank you for the opportunity to present the bill. Senate File 1354 provides a much-needed appropriation to support business development and job creation from what I refer to as homegrown businesses. Senate File 1354 would appropriate $500,000 over the biennium from the general fund to expand the capacity of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund to help entrepreneurs start and grow their businesses in northeastern Minnesota. Since 1989, the Entrepreneur Fund has helped start, stabilize, or expand over 900 businesses, creating or retaining over 2,300 jobs in northeastern Minnesota. Its loan funds have made 450 loans, totaling $6.6 million, and helped businesses leverage an additional $14 million in financing from public and private sources. Over 7,700 people have accessed the Entrepreneur Fund's business training and technical assistance services. Entrepreneur Fund services focus on creating successful business owners and healthy businesses. Training, technical assistance, and support are critical elements of business success. Remarkably, over 85% of the business owners, most of whom are startups, are still in business 2 years after receiving assistance. The Entrepreneur Fund helped the owners of Brigham SCS Air Interiors in Duluth transform their business from a custom upholstery job shop to a manufacturing facility. And Brigham has, since the inception of Cirrus Aviation, which is an aviation industry in Duluth that employs over 700 people now, it started up in the 1990s. Brigham now provides the interior finishing for all the Cirrus airplanes, which are about 700 airplanes a year this past year. And they have grown to 13 full-time employees and one part-time employee. The Northeast Entrepreneur Fund is seeking state support to provide technical assistance and business training for a very small startup, for very small startup businesses, rather. These are These are enterprises that start with just a few jobs, but ultimately can support a family, and in some cases grow into larger enterprises. For a modest investment, we can support these local entrepreneurs with the technical assistance that is necessary to get them started with a good business plan and help them find sources of financing that meet their business startup needs. We are talking about modest investments in these businesses in order to get them started with a firm foundation and good prospects for success. And I have with me today Mary Matthews, president of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund, who can describe for you the work that they hope to accomplish with this appropriation. This organization has an outstanding track record, having received national recognition for its work with very small business startups. Once Ms. Matthews has had a chance to describe her program, we would be pleased to respond to any questions that you may have.
Good. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mary Matthews. I'm president of the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund. I'm here today to talk to you about two initiatives for which we hope to use the funding that we're asking the legislature for this year. One is, as the senator described, to expand our technical assistance for small businesses in northeastern Minnesota, particularly those who are accessing financing, both loans and equity, through the Northeast Entrepreneur Fund. This assistance, technical assistance tied to financing, dramatically increases the potential that businesses can survive and thrive. And with this appropriation, we would provide intensive technical assistance to 50 entrepreneurs who are accessing financing. The second part of this request is to help us launch a collaborative effort in northeastern Minnesota that would help our region grow wealth, employment, and new tax base with a focus on maintaining and enhancing the quality of life in our region. With few exceptions, most of our economic development efforts are focused on recruiting businesses. We want to shift the focus to growing, to investing more energy and growing our own locally based businesses and entrepreneurial talent. And with this appropriation from the legislature, we would, as a region, hope to dramatically increase the number of entrepreneurs who are successful in northeastern Minnesota. Local entrepreneurs and businesses need two kinds of assistance. They need transactional assistance, that's business plans, market plans, loan applications, to grow the stage of their business. But entrepreneurs need transformational help to grow their personal skills as an entrepreneur. With over 30 partners to date, the Entrepreneur Fund is proposing an organized and collaborative 10-year strategy that would help change as a region how we grow entrepreneurs. Since this is hockey tournament week, think about the hockey process and compare growing entrepreneurs to how we build hockey teams. We start with peewees for children, and we grow up to through schools into college hockey, into professional hockey systems. And there's an organized, intentional way in which hockey players grow their skills and their ability, and they're able to rise to the level of that they're capable of performing. It's based on their skill and their motivation. We want to grow entrepreneurs the same way. Our regional plan has three elements. First, it looks at the culture and education, looks at building the environment, an environment that supports entrepreneurship. It would include introducing entrepreneurship education in K through 16, as well as efforts that would change community attitudes. We would create a service provider network with all of our regional partners, both public and private, to ensure that entrepreneurs get the right services at the right price at the right time. And thirdly, we would add professional coaching. Much like in hockey, professional, accountable coaches that help team members develop their skills. And with the professional coach, entrepreneurs would work one-on-one and in teams of like-skills entrepreneurs to grow their skills. So what do we hope to accomplish? We hope to accomplish changes in entrepreneurial skills. We want to grow companies that can create wealth and jobs and find new markets. We want to create individual and community wealth, changes in the entrepreneurial environment, and a systematic systems change is how the region we grow entrepreneurs. So our request for $500,000 for the biennium would be used in two ways. Initially, as I said, would be training or technical assistance and support for 50 entrepreneurs who are accessing loans or equity financing. And the second part would be to provide professional coaching for 30 entrepreneurs to grow their skills as entrepreneurs so that they can grow their businesses. For this investment, we would provide the state a minimum of a 2-to-1 match with foundation and federal dollars. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Has the state been a participant in the past on this?
The state through an appropriation through deed in the late 90s provided us small amounts of funding through the Microenterprise Technical Assistance Grant Program. The state has not provided any funding to date for this new venture, the Entrepreneurial Development System.
Okay, that's...
Mr. Chairman.
You believe that this has created about 2,300 jobs, huh?
The Northeast Entrepreneur Fund has, yes.
Very successful. And I imagine some of these funds can leverage a lot more funds in the private sector and other... What other public sectors would you get IRRB get involved at all?
We've received some funding from Iron Range Resources, and we'll be asking them again for some funding for next year. We received some funding from them in the early 90s. We received funding from the U.S. Small Business Administration, USDA Rural Development. We've received some funding through community development block grant programs, through entitlement community development block grant. We've had support over the years from many foundations, including the Northland Foundation and Blandin and Northwest Area Foundations.
How's that Plum Bun Bakery doing? Pretty good stuff?
They're doing really well, and I haven't tasted them, but I've heard great reports about their bakery.
Senator Scheidt.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Matthews mentioned that there was a match. Is that required in your original money? It's not in this in the language here. Is that something that you already have as
a
requirement of other money you've received? I thought you said, Ms. Matthews, that you would be matching these dollars.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheidt, it's not required, but she says that she's able to leverage her funds and intends to leverage 2-to-1.
Is that correct?
2-to-1 from federal grants and from private donations.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, do we...
Senator Scheidt.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Mr. Fuller could help. Do we normally require that? I mean, I'm certainly supportive, and I just wondered if...
It's all different kinds of... I think it's the answer is it's kind of all over the board, you know, different. What do you... Yeah, so Mr. whatever your name is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheidt, yeah, there's a mix. Sometimes they require matches.
Okay.
Sometimes they don't.
Seems to me like you've gotten a heck of a bang for the buck. You know, anytime you can help 450 businesses and create 2,300 jobs for not a lot of state and local effort, but it leverages. Okay, I think we ought to move on this one and
Mr. Chairman, I'd
to pass and to the Finance Committee. Senator Scheidt, is that
Chairman,
your motion?
Yes, I'd move Senate File 1354 be recommended to pass, and that would be referred to the Finance Committee.
That's correct, yep. On the Scheidt motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair and committee members.
Sharon and Senator Rosen. Rural Renewable Energy Initiatives. This is going to be I've heard that going forward, a $10 or $20, $30 billion growing business in Minnesota. And,
that's correct.
And I believe that's part of why what you're doing here is to create some chances here for people. Senator Sharon and Senator Rosen, Senate File 1205.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen. I am really thrilled to be here under a different subject this time.
Is this a smoking ban? No. This is.
Excuse me a moment while I light up.
Yeah.
Okay. Chairman, I think don't we have amendments?
Already lit up.
Senator,
got some
laughter.
Smoking amendments going on. And they're all germane.
Yeah, they all really.
Okay.
Okay, where were we here?
I don't know.
I really am pleased to be here on what I think is one of the most exciting proposals to come in front of us this year, because it is related to this wonderful new world that we're moving into of renewable energy and decreased reliance on fossil fuels and all of the industry potential and possibilities that will be coming to us in the state of Minnesota for that. This Renewable Energy and Economic Development Consortium proposal, I would like you to understand that central to this proposal, and what I want you to understand in looking at it, is a unique linkage of applied research expertise in the engineering and biotechnology areas to support the development of new and emergent industry. The bill itself requests an appropriation of $7.5 million in fiscal year 2008 and another $7.5 in 2009, appropriated from the general fund and given to the commissioner of the Employment and Economic Development Department. And the commissioner, working with the Rural Renewable Energy Economic Development Consortium, we haven't quite got an acronym for that one yet, will use $5 million of those dollars in year one and $5 million of those in year two for zero-interest matching loans up to units of $500,000 to support renewable energy-related businesses and enterprises developing or locating and expanding in the rural area. The goal of this bill is to create jobs, create industry, and to help the rural area continue to benefit from this new industry. The commissioner also will grant from those dollars $2,500,000 in each of the fiscal years to the Rural Renewable Energy Economic Development Consortium for research and technical support, workforce training, and equipment that will be housed at Minnesota State University. And that consortium will report to the commissioner of deed every year. Now, what you have received is a handout that looks like this. I'm hoping that you've received this handout.
Yeah, we have it. Yep.
And after the first page really summarizes what I've just said, but the rest of the handout helps you understand who the consortium is, the criteria that will be used for making the loans through the Department of Economic Development, who is eligible for this money. Then if you turn the page, it will talk further about the consortium that will oversee the distribution of $5 million for the support services that brings that link between the applied research and the development of real jobs in the rural area. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my co-author, Senator Rosen.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow members. This is truly very exciting to be in front of you with this, and I must applaud Senator Sharon for doing all the heavy lifting on this bill. She really does understand what's happening out here. Just to give you a brief summary of why this bill is before you and where this came from, is we have this I-90 group, and it's a bipartisan group of legislators in southern Minnesota that have gotten together to work on the issues that link us, our common bonds. And one of the number one issues is something that is one of our strongest possibilities in southern Minnesota is the renewable energy, and not only just because of our resources, but because of the public institutions down there. Also should say, though, that this is not just for southern Minnesota. This is also for biomass and timber. But because of our working relationship with the House and the Senate in this bipartisan fashion, this is where this bill comes from. So we are taking our strongest linkage, our strongest possibilities in developing something here that we should go forward with as far as job creation. That's our biggest issue out in greater Minnesota. And I also should say, too, that we have so much, all the bills that we're hearing in energy and the bills that we've heard in your committee, too, Mr. Chair, as far as biotechnology, this all is summarized into this bill. We have so many possibilities out there. So many technologies that are coming down the pipeline. Sharing the wealth is another issue of getting that information out to everybody and capitalizing on our possibilities.
Exciting stuff, isn't it? Huh?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Metzen. I have some persons here from industry and from economic development and from Minnesota State University who would like to just highlight some of the special opportunities that are in this bill. And if I could draw your attention to the Renewable Energy Economic Development Consortium membership, you will see more clearly how comprehensive the consortium is, and that it includes members of the applied science and research systems throughout Mankato, Winona, Riverland, MinWest, and Itasca. It's really a comprehensive collaborative for rural Minnesota. And with that, with your permission, may I introduce...
I think before that, Senator Michelle moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the form you'd like, I believe.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Michelle motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Yeah, you folks can speak briefly.
First, I would like to introduce to you Jonathan Zert. Jonathan is the Chief Executive Officer for the Greater Mankato Area Economic Development Authority.
Welcome to the committee, and to everybody that speaks, state your name for the records.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Jonathan Zert,
and I lead the Greater Mankato Economic Development Corporation. I want to just amplify some of the points that the two senators have done a great job of really describing to you the details of the proposal, the bill, and how it would work and how it would function. But what I want to bring to that is really put some volume to this notion of commercialization. There's a tremendous amount of science that's out there, science that's being developed, science that's occurring in front of us, and this is about commercializing that science. Commercialization means the creation of companies. It means the creation of opportunities for people to work, to learn, to earn good livings, and to be a part of our economies in all of Minnesota. Now, one of the things that happened this week was just last week, the Kauffman Foundation, if you're not familiar with the Kauffman Foundation, it's based out of Kansas City. It's probably one of this country's foremost leading experts on entrepreneurial activity and innovation. And in a report this week, they released two reports. One was on A Road to an Entrepreneurial Economy, a Research and Policy Guide, and this is published February 26th. One of the points that they talked about was that economic growth will require continued entrepreneurial innovation. Now, that's probably not any surprise, but within the points that they identify, four key points, the third is this: promoting innovation. Innovative entrepreneurship cannot occur unless the innovation pipeline is full and incentives for commercializing innovation are in place. This bill does exactly that. It puts incentives in place for commercialization. I'd also reference a second report that they released at the same time, and it was an index that they called on the new economy. And in the new economy, they identified nine key strategies that states could employ to participate in the new economy. Now, if we were scoring this piece of legislation, which the authors didn't have privy to this information because it was just released within the last week, of the nine key strategies that they identified, listen to four of them. First, align incentives behind innovation economy fundamentals. That's the matching loan money. Second, co-invest in an innovation infrastructure. Innovation infrastructure, that's the faculty and that's the equipment that this bill puts in place. Third, co-invest in the skills of workforce. You also see a component in there for workforce training. And fourth, support industry clusters. Well, industry clusters are about concentrations of knowledge and about skill. And Michael Porter would tell you that that's the underpinning of an industry cluster, and that's what exactly what this does is it creates a center of knowledge and information related to that industry. So without knowing it, this bill hits on four of these key nine strategies. And the last point I'd identify is when they define this new economy, they talk about the retention, the creation of high-valued companies and jobs, and they say this: the degree to which state economies are knowledge-based, globalized, entrepreneurial, information technology-driven, and innovation-based. To that degree, they'll be successful, and I would submit that this bill does exactly all of those things, and it creates that environment that fosters innovation, helps develop skills, and create jobs and create opportunities for companies.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to introduce Dave Sunderman. Dave Sunderman is here representing Frost Bankel.
I'm Dave Sunderman. Work at Benco Rural Electric Cooperative. We are a distribution cooperative. We're part of Great River Energy. And I think this system that you're looking at putting in place is something that's very needed. You look at we're at point A and we need to get to point B. And there's a lot of things that are happening, and it's moving quite quickly, but to have incentives in place and to have research and technology support for private investors that want to come in and enhance new technology is something that is very needed. I correlate it to our business. If you look at the wind generation, if you go back a few years ago, the price was double of what it is now, equipment breaking down, that type of thing. But with incentives, more people kept driving forward to have more wind generation. And as a result of that, we've seen a lot of positive things that have come out of it. And and that's what we need to do is use our rural renewable resources and get to that end product throughout our entire state. You can list out all the different things that are going on now, but if we don't have incentives in place to bring investors forward and to use the technology resources that we have through higher ed, I think it would be a missed opportunity.
Thank you. And then our final presenter, if you would indulge us, Chairman Metzen, is Dr. John Fry from sure. Minnesota State University.
Pardon? Welcome.
And what I want to draw your attention again to this handout. What Dr. Fry is going to be referring to is the $5 million that will be used for this linkage of applied science to the creation of commerce. And it's the last page of the handout, and that is the section that Dr. Fry will be referring to. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am John Fry. I'm Dean of the College of Science, Engineering, and Technology at Minnesota State University, Mankato. I would also like to introduce my president, President Richard Davenport, over there, if he could stand. Thank you.
Welcome.
And I would like to go to explain, and I think I can best do it by examples, of how we can link the business sector to the education sector. And I'm going to give a couple of examples because they really are germane to the energy and the biofuels renewable energy area. The first example I'm going to give I'm going to talk about our automotive engineering program at Minnesota State. Over the past years, they have gained national recognition in their work with renewable fuels. They are currently working on several projects with putting batteries in Priuses for extended mileage. They're working on other projects where they are using blended fuels above the 10%. And as you recall, all fuels above 10%, with the exception of E85, will require EPA approval. One of the things that we're developing in our area is a laboratory that will have EPA certification for monitoring engines and engine products that will be installed that will have EPA approval that will need certification. Because we don't know where the fuels are going to go, we assume that it's going to go above E10, but all of these will have to have will be certified. And right now, the closest certification is in Denver, Colorado. So there's a wide open market in the Midwest. And when we talk about this, we're talking about the linkage of university to businesses, because there's going to be a lot of products. There's going to be a lot of innovation, aftermarket products to match the vehicles, the engines to the new fuels. I think we also need to realize that this is a broad-based project, because it not only includes MSU, but it includes other universities within the Minnesota Center for Engineering and Manufacturing Excellence, including Itasca up in the North Range, where there's an immense amount of timber, as well as Minnesota West in the South, where there is good agriculture. And with that, I will pass it on to Senator Sharon.
And I'm going to pass it on to Senator Rosen.
Yeah, a pretty good tag team there. Yeah.
Yes.
You guys, did you practice this now? Yes. For a couple of days or what?
We've been working on this, right?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you can tell, it's pretty exciting to see this collaborative and unique relationship between the state and private sector and our public institutions as far as research and this whole development in renewable energy. And I just would like to say just a couple things what's happening in the area of not only the alternative fuels, which Dr. Fry mentioned, but in renewable energy. They are making ethanol by microwaving it. And they can do that for, I believe it's half the cost. It might be more than that. And it's truly exciting, the technology that's out there. And we have set ourselves up as a state to capitalize on this. And it should be out in greater Minnesota where all this energy is happening. So I'm very excited about this bill. And, again, I want to thank Senator Sharon for working with the group here. And, like I said, it is an I-90 initiative, and we're working very hard in the House, too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, so I don't know if it's a concern or not, but how the little businesses can get involved. I
expect a consortium to listen to. In other words, this is all good stuff, but I hate to see just the big giants coming in and getting, and I'm sure that the locals, the consortium would look at the little players too, and maybe so you could step, they could get a little step up too. Is that correct? I see a lot of nods here, and I think once in a while we do things around here and we knowingly or unknowingly probably help big giants, you know, and that's fine because we need, you know, the big stuff too.
Thank you, Chairman Metzen. I think our experience in the rural area is that we grow, the businesses that we grow from the entrepreneur, the small, sometimes the cottage industry, something small that we invest in an entrepreneurial way, give them some space to begin to develop their idea, and then they build their business in our area, and people are employed in our area. That's our history. We know that that's where most of our success comes from. This is up to $500,000, but it doesn't mean that it has to be that big of a matching loan. It can be smaller loans as well.
That's exactly at least one senator I wanted to know that's what you're doing, and I assume that. But
I think that what you're alerting me to and what we can do in the language that we have for how these loans are made is to maybe put something more specific in there about consideration for small startups as well as...
Yeah, I just didn't see anything in it, so I have to trust the consortium to... Not I, I mean, the language just doesn't...
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, could I please... Yes, I would like to move Senate File 1205 to lay over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, please.
Go to the Finance Committee next, and then they'll do that.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further discussion?
I don't know.
All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank you.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've also got an author's delete all.
Okay, Senator Day, delete all to get the bill in the chamber. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Mr. Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This bill revisits the issue of misclassification of construction employees using the 1099 classification or independent contractor classification. Problem is that when misclassification of these employees occurs, when workers who should be issued W-2 forms earning a wage or a salary end up being illegally declared as 1099 independent contractors. And this classification or misclassification is done for certain reasons to get around certain tax laws, certain workers' compensation issues, certain other insurance issues. What ends up happening is this illegal misclassification puts legitimate businesses at a competitive disadvantage. It also cheats the state out of millions of dollars of revenue. In fact, the legislative auditor estimated that Minnesota loses about $600 million in uncollected income taxes because of underreporting of income from non-wage earners. This ends up shifting financial and other risks onto workers. It dumps costs onto hospitals, insurers, competitors, and taxpayers. And it opens the door for additional illegal activities, such as wage and hour violations and use of undocumented workers. The evidence suggests that illegal misclassification is growing. Recent studies in Illinois, Massachusetts, and Maine estimate that as many as 24% of construction workers are misclassified, And companies that do choose to misclassify do it a lot because the advantages easily outweigh the risks. The law is clear. However, enforcement is another matter. So this bill gets at the enforcement of the misclassification of 1099s. In a nutshell, we're creating a certification or certificate of independent contractors so that we are able to more closely track these activities and so that the money is not going under the table as much as it is. And with me to talk a little bit more about this issue is Kyle Macarius from the Lakes and Plains Regional Council of Carpenters.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator and members. My name is Kyle Macarius. I'm the Legislative Director of the Lakes and Plains Regional Council of Carpenters. The issue of worker misclassification in the construction industry is not a new problem, but it is a widely acknowledged problem and one that studies show is rampant in the construction industry. Senator Chowdhury did a great job of kind of giving you an overview of the problem, so I'll skip most of that. But I do want to just make clear that by misclassifying employees as independent contractor, people who should be receiving W-2s and earning wages and giving them 1099s and contract payments instead, the contractors who cheat don't have to withhold taxes or pay Social Security benefits. They don't have to pay workers' compensation or unemployment insurance, all costs which legitimate companies do have to take on. I do want to make clear that we have no problems with legitimate independent contractors. We definitely acknowledge that they are out there and they provide a very strong benefit to our communities. We're talking about people who are employees who are simply classified as independent contractors. Senate File 1103 was developed in consultation between our union, between employers, and with the Department of Labor and Industry. It is a good bill that will make significant difference towards fixing this problem. Here's how it will work. Independent contractors, those legitimate independent contractors, will register with the Department of Labor and Industry. They will pay a $150 fee. The certificate will be renewable every 2 years. They will sign a document that certifies under penalty of fine that they meet the tests that are already exist in law to be an independent contractor, tests such as they have a federal tax ID number, they have their own business address, own their own tools, take on the risks and liabilities and potential for profit that a real business takes on and are not simply paid by the hour. Contractors who wish to hire independent contractors will have to verify that the independent they're hiring has one of these certificates. And contractors who don't do this or who coerce employees into filing for these certificates will also be subject to fines. And most importantly, the threat hanging over cheaters with this bill is that the Commissioner of Labor will share this information with the Department of Revenue. So the threat of a tax audit will hang over people who now wish to cheat the system. So we're not actually changing the law with this bill in terms of who is an independent contractor or who is an employee. What we're trying to do is raise the risk of cheating. Mr. Chair, committee members, I appreciate your consideration of Senate File 1103. I would be glad to go into more detail about the problem or answer any questions anyone might have about this bill. But we do have a couple of other folks, I believe, who will say something about this bill as well.
Aren't there enough, I think you're going in the right direction, but I would think that, just my thought, that there would be enough laws on the books today to get these cheaters, and the Department of Revenue should be out there finding them today and yesterday and last year. I understand what you're trying to do is toughen it up, but is it not being enforced today?
Mr. Chairman, members,
or aren't there enough laws on the books to get these people? I would think there would be, but I don't.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, members, there is a law that says kind of you shall not misclassify an employee, and the law does clearly also state what the requirements are for the difference between an employee and independent contractor. And I will say that the Department of Revenue, in particular its withholding division, in the last year or so has really stepped up enforcement from the tax side to try and, I mean, they know there's a ton of money out there to that they potentially could rake in by clamping down this problem. So they are aware of the problem. I believe that there is not a mechanism in place through which enforcement could be done without a significant administrative burden, and I will defer specific questions about that to the department. But
so with this filing and $150, we'd have a better. All right, Senator Scheid.
To answer your question a little further, Mr. Chair, you've got, in order to enforce the law, you need to either have people to go out and search for, kind of do random audits and field audits of whether the person who is a 1099 employee actually fits this list of nine criteria that is laid out to be a contractor. You know, do they have a separate office? Do they kind of have their own tools? Are they separate enough to be deemed an independent contractor? Short of that, we honestly don't have much to detect whether that person is being an independent contractor under the table. So this way, you get the certificate. You're either a W-2 employee or you have a certificate. And if you have a certificate, you can then cross-match whether those people are paying the right taxes or not.
Senator Saltzman?
Yes. On your question, Mr. Chair, I've had some personal experience with this. As I was a consultant, I started out as a consultant, and the IRS came into our organization because there was another consultant who came on and did an audit, and that required extensive time. And one of the issues that they came up with was that, are you truly independent, or are you being directed in your work? And as a result of that, the organization that I worked for decided that I was an employee and no longer a consultant. And it was fine. There was nothing we were trying to hide with that. But there was a long process that was really that was addressed. So there is some, not just enforcement, but there is an audit. But really the defining issue is, who's providing the supervision? And are you truly independent? Are you given a job and doing it, or are you under supervision of someone in doing your work? And I guess that I think that's what you're talking about here to some degree, is are people coming in and trying to get around the law with workers' compensation and some of those other areas. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think that's part of the thrust of the bill, or I would say.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I think that the issue is complicated enough that they do need the structure here that's provided in the bill to be able to go after the abuses. I do have a technical question. I'm looking at the Delete Everything Amendment, and on line 1.25, it says the requirements in clauses 1 and 2. Is that referring to the clauses 1 and 2 in subdivision 6? It says those clauses have to be met, but then when you get over to subdivision 6, it says you have to meet all of them. I'm assuming from what Senator Chaudhry said, you have to meet all 9. Am I?
Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Fuller.
The clauses 1 or 2 are those contained in subdivision 4 on line 22 and on line 24.
Okay.
Senator Chaudhry, did you have another witness or two?
Yes, and just wanted to add before I relinquish my chair that we did get this. This delete all is based on the suggestion from the Department of Commerce. Excuse me, Department of Labor and Industry. I think John Ness from Management Guidance, Inc.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Nessie, and I represent several construction employer associations. The issue of misclassified independent contractors affects all of them, but two of them have an especially vested interest in this issue. Those are the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association and the Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association. The reason for their special interest is that the drywall and floor covering industries are notorious for the use of misclassified independent contractors, along with roofing and some others. And as you've heard, it's no surprise that this is such a common practice. Some estimates put the savings to an employer at 30% for hiring an independent contractor rather than hiring a proper employee to do their work. And despite the fact that it's illegal, again, there's very little enforcement out there because it's so difficult to track. My contractors are competing against those misclassified independent contractors on a daily basis. It's been in the residential market for years, and with the slowdown recently in the residential market, it's creeping more and more into the commercial market, which, of course, means more money and a higher profile. I think it's unanimous at this point among construction industry stakeholders that something needs to be done to stop this problem or at least slow it down. And the contractors I represent would support measures that would help level the playing field among the legitimate contractors, them and the legitimate independent contractors. One of our concerns is that any legislation not unnecessarily burden those that are already trying to follow the law. And by burden, I'm referring to additional unnecessary administrative issues or further liability for legitimate contractors. But I think that this bill does satisfy those concerns. I think that it provides a sound mechanism for the registration of legitimate independent contractors and discourages the use of misclassified independent contractors in the construction industry by tracking independent contractors through the system. I don't think this is a silver bullet, and I'm not sure that one actually exists for this problem, but I definitely think it's a big step in the right direction. Thank you.
I see that number again, that it's estimated $604 million a year lose on uncollected income taxes. A year, that's do a lot of
and my
education or K through 12 or whatever.
Mr. Chair, my contractors lose a lot of jobs to those independent contractors because of this
jobs
situation. Yep.
Unemployment top that's not being paid. Other issues. Any other? I think there's a
department
wants to.
Mr. Chairman, John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry. Actually, I really didn't need to speak to the bill except that we did work with the authors on creating the new language, but while I was listening to the testimony and you talking about the fact and the previous witness talking about the fact that it is really hard to crack down on these people, the commissioner mentioned on Monday to me that as we put this together, and it's been kind of a fast track, even though we've been working with the senator on this for a while, this will be referred to Finance Committee, not just because of the fees, but the necessity to hire some actual people to go out and do the inspections. And
judiciary first.
I don't know if...
It'd go to judiciary first, I believe.
Judiciary and then finance. All I really had to comment on.
Okay, Lisa, did you wish to...
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Lisa Furnett with the Builders Association of Minnesota, and I just wanted to comment that we are trying to meet with the Department of Revenue and other members interested in this so that we can work in bringing these people into compliance with each other. We did not know until now that the Department of Labor and Industry was carrying this bill, but we have been working with the Department of Revenue on the issue.
So you're not objecting to legislation?
Not objecting to it. I'm hoping that we can come to some sort of consensus.
Senator Rosen, did you wish to move the bill?
Move the bill, please.
And I think somebody asked for it in Judiciary, and then after that, I believe Finance. So on the Rosen motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Senator Boniff, how long would you... We've Higgins is up before you, Senator Higgins. We're trying to find her. Could you do hers in a...
Sure.
She's hiding.
To just grab one more chair.
Are you afraid to leave things?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have before you a bill with regard to telecommuting, and what this bill does is it offers a tax incentive for either an employee or an employer. The employer will have the choice of whether or not to offer the tax credit directly to the employee or keep the tax credit for themselves, depending on their own business policy. But it offers an incentive so that businesses take advantage of the very many benefits that telecommuting can provide to all of us. And so just first, before I have two witnesses here to speak on behalf of the bill, but I want to just talk for a moment about the benefits of telecommuting, because I think we don't often think about that. And telecommuting provides many benefits to both employers and employees. It actually can reduce global warming emissions and traffic congestion. They say it could be one of the easiest and quickest ways to reduce congestion on our roads. If you take those people out of the traffic lanes during rush hour, that has significant effect. It can reduce sick leave. Oftentimes, you could be contagious, think you need to stay home, but if you were at home, you might be willing to work, and it allows more employment opportunities for people with disabilities. And another benefit is particularly for women, as they have their children and may feel like they want to be back in the workforce, but they're torn between those choices. I know I actually took advantage of that after I first had my children with both my two boys, where I was able to negotiate an agreement with my employer to work out of the home for some period of time. Just having that extra added flexibility allowed me to stay in the workforce, keep earning income, and feel a little bit better about leaving small children at home alone. So just some statistics. Telecommuting just one day a week for a year can save the typical commuter about 1,200 miles on his or her vehicle and more than 58 gallons of gas. And if your commute is more than the average 25 miles round trip, you could save even more time, money, and gas. So that's an employee benefit. An employer benefit, they've done studies that show that a formal telework program can improve productivity by as much as 26% or more. And specifically, again, this is, you know, employees spend less time commuting, leading to more time and less stress, fewer interruptions, better able to manage business and personal demands, reduced weather-related work. This past blizzard, you can imagine, if people were able to work at home. And, you know, we are a forefront in our state because Best Buy has done an extensive pilot program offering telecommuting benefits to those employees who are willing to do that. And I had, I still would like to have Best Buy at some point talk to us about that, but we were not able to make that happen for today. Let's see. I think with regard to the specific bill, what I would like you to note, and the way this bill would go is it would go to the tax committee. But before I go any further, I do have an amendment. So I offer the A1 amendment.
Senator Bono?
I do move the A1 amendment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Same sign. Amendment passes.
Thank you. And what specifically the tax policy is that we're saying that when an employee becomes a telecommuter, that there's a expense related to shifting from being a regular employee to being a telecommuter, and we're calling that a conversion expense. And so we're saying that there is a tax credit of up to 30% of the telecommuting conversion expense of that converting employee, with a maximum credit of $500. The amendment shifts those dollars from 30%. And we really were just trying to make something that was advantageous enough to incent people to do it. And then, as you can see, the second part of the credit is for the ongoing incentive, and that remains with the lesser amount. So with that, I would like to invite my witnesses to speak. And first, I'll Mike Noble.
similar point, Senator Bonhoeff. In the Transportation Committee, I've been doing some work on funding, and some of the federal funding now requires that the state also have something like this in place.
Really?
So I glanced at that, and I am on Senator Sieben's bill on the same issue, and I was thinking, bingo, so we may look at this as something that may leverage some additional federal dollars for our transportation project. So I'll try to find that for you for the next time that you take this bill out.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I do support Senator Sieben's bill. And I know just one of the differences is her bill, I believe, has the incentive solely to the telecommuter rather than the choice of the business or the telecommuter. I'm not sure. But either bill can travel is fine with me.
Madam Chair. Just before we get to the witnesses, for the author, Senator Bonhoeff, can you help define for me what an expense associated with a conversion would be? I'm
sure
thinking
a computer for the home, a printer, exactly. Some of those expenses to set up a home office. And then for a business, the business side of things, you know, if you're used to having all your workers be on site, you may have to have video conferencing. Think about it. If you had workers now in the homes and you had an every Monday morning meeting, you might want to purchase video conferencing equipment or things like that.
Madam Chair, I think it sounds like now I know why Best Buy would like this.
Right? Right. Yeah, it sounds like a windfall for Best Buy, doesn't it, Madam Chair? So thank you.
I think is that right now, if you have an office that if your place of business offers you an office, you cannot deduct for a home office. So this also kind of addresses that particular fact, I would guess, that if you want to have a home office at this point in time and you cannot deduct these kinds of expenses. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, I do not know that that is the case because I'm familiar with people who do deduct home offices. So that's I would like to look into that.
It is based on the fact that your company does not provide you, if you're a consultant,
if you have a separate business office.
You know something. For 10 years. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't aware of that.
Madam Chair, yes. I think I had the – I looked into it at one point relating to my law practice. And I've got a law office, and I cannot deduct the home office that I have because I've got a separate office for my law practice.
Madam Chair.
I can only have one. That's it.
Madam Chair, I want to let the witnesses testify. I just want you to know that I have, someday you may be back requiring people to at least come to work one day a week so that we don't become a total antisocial society. You know, I understand my concern is that we never see each other. But I know
thank
I support
you, Senator
the bill.
Shine. Senator Madam Chair, Senator Shine.
Go to our testifiers. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair, my name is Michael Noble. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit group called Fresh Energy. And we work on transportation-related issues because they affect our energy consumption. This bill is a very innovative way to move Minnesota forward on one of the smartest and cheapest ways to reduce congestion on our highways, reduce the use of oil, move us toward energy independence, all those things that we say are important. This is surely one of the most cost-effective and innovative ways to do that, by encouraging increased telecommuting. The studies that have been done on telecommuting show that so much time is wasted in traffic jams and so much fuel is wasted in traffic jams that just taking literally, even if it was one day a week that you were at home, if every worker just were one day a week, you'd be taking 20% of the pressure off our highway system, which is surely a more cost-effective approach to reducing congestion than building new lanes. So the committee wishes, we could provide more information, more data, but this is primarily about reducing fossil fuel use, reducing congestion, providing increased flexibility to both businesses and their employees, all good things, and I don't think there's really any controversial side.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jason Flores. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Twin West Chamber of Commerce, representing about 1,000 member businesses in the western suburbs of Minneapolis. We support telecommuting for many of the reasons already mentioned by Senator Bonoff, and it's something that many of our member businesses are already exploring and looking to invest in for those exact same reasons. Over 80% of our members are small businesses, and small business does still form the backbone of our economy. As employers everywhere face ever tighter margins, proposals such as this one that help these small businesses stay competitive and work more efficiently can really help make a difference. In addition, as the metro area looks to add over 1 million new residents onto an already overburdened transportation system, we have to continually seek new ways to give our employees more flexibility and opportunities to work and travel more efficiently. So for these reasons and many of the ones already mentioned, we are also supportive of this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Are there any questions to Senator Rosen? Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Bonoff, I do believe that your bill also works very well for telecommuting out in greater Minnesota also, which we haven't addressed. Yeah.
Very
and
good.
And we welcome people to be able to do their jobs out in greater Minnesota. They bring their children. They want the quality of life on blah, blah, blah. But it is an issue for us out there.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Senator Bonoff, would you like to move the bill over to taxes, I believe?
Yes. So moved.
All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Senate file 593 passes to the tax committee. Senator Higgins, are you here? Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Somebody has to pay taxes.
I can't hear you, Madam Chair.
Is that better? Okay.
Yes.
Is Paul Cassidy with you today to testify?
He's not with me.
Okay,
but
very
he's
good.
Here.
He's here. Okay, very good.
And I have handouts, please.
Absolutely. Thank. If we could have the handouts passed around the table as well.
Madam Chair, we got through most of the testimony from the people who are supporting this bill the last time we were here. You probably want to call for the opponents.
Very good. Senator Higgins also has another handout as well. Is there anyone else here to speak in favor of this? Okay. Then I believe Mr. Cassidy is here. Thank you for coming back. I know you were here, I think, a week ago Monday. Thank you for coming back on Senate File 443.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the law firm of Leonard Street & Dinard. I'm here on behalf of the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, better known as ISRI. ISRI has numerous concerns with this legislation. The legislation attempts to what we agree to address what we agree is a very serious problem that potentially endangers citizens and the public safety community. ISRI recognized this problem long ago and has been working to implement extensive practices and procedures within their industry intended to reduce metal thefts and deter criminals from attempting to transact business at their yards. I hope you take a few moments today to hear concerns of ISRI, what they as an industry have done on a voluntary basis to address the issue of metals theft at the national, state, and local level, and finally, the parameters of a solution that we believe would address this issue and get to the heart of Senator Higgins' concerns. I also have with me members of ISRI who would like to provide a few comments. First, our concerns of the legislation as amended. Section 2 of the bill requires a scrap dealer to collect, retain, and transmit large amounts of transactional data to law enforcement agencies on a weekly basis. This is an administrative burden that creates nothing but unnecessary paperwork on both ends. And to what end? Unless law enforcement has an open investigation file, what will they do with the data and when they get it? It's unlikely that law enforcement has the time or resources to conduct any type of meaningful review that would lead to any type of increase in convictions or deter any further criminal activity. There's just too much information to go through. We'd suggest that we standardize what information that we collect from that a scrap dealer collects, and that law enforcement be given access to that information at any opportunity when the upon request after an open investigation on a criminal matter has begun. That's already the standard operating procedure that most yards work under today. More alarming is the legislation's suggested option of using the automated pawn system, or APS, which I think all of you are getting educated on in the last couple of weeks. APS has no relevance to the purchase of the sale of scrap metal. Scrap metal is not a Sony television, and it's not a set of Callaway golf clubs. Scrap metal is not uniquely identifiable. It doesn't have a model number or a serial number, and no one puts their name on the copper plumbing or wiring in their homes. It's simply a material with no unique characteristics that is of any use to the law enforcement community. One law enforcement community, I believe, testified in committee that recently that and said as much that a criminal that would have to be apprehended actually leaving the scene of a crime for any of this material to be of any value to them. The APS system has other problems as well. It's important to ask whether the APS system is effective and whether it leads to more convictions and deters criminal activity, or does it simply allow for the collection of new fees? It's not unusual for our yards to process dozens of small transactions a day, some for as little as $10. That doesn't include an APS fee tagged on top of the transaction for $1 to $3 per transaction that's passed directly onto the consumer unless the scrapyard chooses or the pawn shop chooses to eat the fee. The APS system and the video surveillance requirements brings up a number of other issues regarding data privacy. Each customer who comes through a scrapyard's door would now be required to be videotaped, provide personal information such as name, address, driver's license number, and even race. Most of our customers are law-abiding citizens. It's proper or fair to ask, is it proper or fair to ask all of them, of our law-abiding customers, to be subjected to such a system and to have his or her name held in a database for purposes of tracking criminal activity? How about our longstanding corporate customers who transport numerous trucks a day of construction debris? Is it necessary or even right to subject them all to a criminal database? Finally, APS is shared with local law enforcement officials regardless of whether they need the information or even have an open investigation file. This information is also shared with paid subscribers on a daily basis, such as Wisconsin law enforcement officials and communities, as well as even private entities who can become subscribers. Current subscribers include the United Partial Service, the University of St. Thomas, and Abbott Northwestern Hospitals. We're not sure that this was even contemplated when the law was first created or the system was first created. The holding period is required in the proposal from 5 to 10 days that a scrapyard must hold the materials that they take in from customers is also unworkable in a commodities-based business. When we purchase scrap metal on Monday, we pay Monday's prices for those metals, not next Friday's, 5 days later, or even the following Wednesday, 10 days later. We pay today's price. We need to move the metal in and out of the yard very quickly. Scrap yards are commodities. They fluctuate daily, and money is made and lost based on today's prices. Stereos and golf clubs can wait. Metals need to be processed and sold as quickly as possible. Video surveillance of our parking facilities and recording license plate numbers is also impractical and unworkable. Visit our yards. Parking's at a premium. We don't necessarily utilize parking stalls. Recording vehicles and license plates with a fixed video camera would be a shot in the dark at best. You literally would have to have someone operate a camera in order to properly record each and every car that comes in and out of our facility. The proposal also requires a recording of sellers and prospective sellers. We're not sure what or whom a prospective seller would be. Finally, we're opposed to the provision creating a local option for more stringent regulation. The provision in this proposal carries enough bureaucratic burden on the scrap industry. Registration fees, data collection fees, video surveillance of customers, their cars, holding periods, what's left? It would be duplicative. Our guess is that local authorities would simply use the provision to require local registration, generating yet another fee, and add another fee on top of the one already being collected for the automated pawn system. Here's what we propose as an alternative. Many of the provisions we feel will meet your public policy objective, meet Senator Higgins' objectives, and deter criminals from attempting to transact business in our yards. Number one, require scrap dealers to register with the Department of Public Safety every 3 years and to provide registration information so that you can provide registration information to law enforcement agencies throughout the state so that they have up-to-date information and can communicate accordingly with our industry. The purpose of the registration should be to facilitate coordination between law enforcement and scrap yards, not to create a regulatory system that looks like an indictment of every scrap dealer in our state. Limit the types of metal transactions subjected to the new law. Exempting aluminum cans and automobiles is a very good starting point. But as Mr. Stabell from our industry will attest to in his testimony, this still probably covers over half of 16,000 transactions that he does on average a month. Requires scrap dealers to collect and retain for 1 year the customer's name, address, and telephone number, and a photocopy of the customer's driver's license, and a transaction receipt for every transaction subject to the law. Require that a check be cut for only transactions over $75, which I believe is included in the delete all amendment. Finally, I'd like to make this point in terms of shared responsibility. Property owners must be held accountable as well. Property owners of abandoned homes and businesses and active construction sites must be part of the solution and be required to properly secure their property or face penalties for not doing so if their property is vandalized and the law enforcement community is called in. Scrapyards have to secure their property just like any other property owner. Property owners who don't take care to secure their property should face fines and restitution for being nuisance properties that perpetuate criminal activity. Metal theft is just another problem in a long line of problem properties that law enforcement have historically had to deal with because the property owner is absent or negligent in securing their property. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. ISRI takes the issue of scrap metal theft very seriously, and we hope we can work with you and Senator Higgins to find a fair and reasonable solution to this problem. However, this is not the solution. Most scrap yards operate interstate are small family-owned businesses that would not even begin to know how to implement, much less afford, the requirements mandated in this proposal. I'd like to now ask Mr. Stabell and Mr. Leader to provide a few comments as well, and we would stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bell and Mr. Leader, if you'd come forward. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you. My name is Mark Leader. I'm part owner of a recycling company that's been in business in Minnesota for 94 years. I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the gathered senators today for allowing me to participate in this meeting. In addition to owning a recycling business, I'm also the vice president of this local chapter of the Institute of Scrap Recycling Industries, a trade organization that Paul had informed you about. This association, on a local as well as a national level, routinely works with legislatures and government agencies to promote recycling and establish sensible business practices for the good of its members and their communities. Locally, we are trying to get off the ground and use a pilot program to standardize our buying and IDing process and target certain do-not-buy items to combat the theft issues. The scrap recycling business in our state, conservatively, is a billion-dollar industry. We contribute to our state in more ways than other companies. We bring jobs. We create a tax base. We have a variety of job classes for all skill levels. Our jobs keep the state clean. We restore our state rather than deplete it. Minnesota claims and does show performance as one of the more involved states in its goals to recycle. We do this 100% of the time. The state's programs and its efforts to recycle are small in size in comparison to what we do privately without state subsidies. This quiet private industry has done this in the state of Minnesota for nearly 150 years. We in this industry have an understanding of your concerns and are very willing to team with lawmakers in order to produce a workable solution. It seems unwise to create a bad law when it seems that many of those who participate in making such a law may be unfamiliar with our industry, the products, and the unique commodity market structure of these recyclables. Our Minnesota companies must be able to buy and sell scrap like all other competitors in this global market. We cannot be saddled with a hold time on our materials. This is a commodity market that we participate in. To have a hold time placed on our materials takes us out of a live market. Imagine, how would it affect you if I told you that you would not be able to sell your private stock in your retirement fund if you perceived that it was going down? That's what happens when you tell me that I can't sell my recyclables for a certain amount of time. We cannot be at a disadvantage to our competitors in neighboring states or countries. This state cannot afford to lose recycling participation, a tax base that we provide, and the infrastructure of the recycling businesses here in Minnesota. I took a field trip yesterday. My field trip was to a large pawn shop in Minneapolis. I thought it was very interesting. I brought with me some typical scrap items. We have some in the room here that someone might want to show you folks what typical scrap items are. I met the manager, and I was invited to go behind the counter with the manager, and I asked him to explain this pawn system that seems to be surfacing in all our discussions here. I asked this very experienced manager to pretend to enter my items into the system and explain to me how it works. He shook his head, and he said, "Hey, this isn't applicable in any way." He couldn't figure out how to add my products into the mix. He said he had no reason to even suggest that the APS system could begin to work for us. He couldn't accurately enter my items, and Andy here might show you what some of these items are. He proceeded to walk me through a real pawn transaction for a consumer good. The system is based for consumer goods, not these industrial, unidentifiable goods. The system uses identifiable items and key phrases. Think about the word watches, power tools, golf clubs. Then there's assorted subclasses, serial numbers, colors, the name of the manufacturer, sizes, specific measurements of size, gallons, liters, PSI, length, width, etc. The pawn shop I visited is not specifically required to video record the person's mode of transportation or record a license plate, nor do they need to capture by video the person involved in the transaction in a point-blank photo. This is in contrast to what's proposed for recycling. Why is it? A common theme that we share with the pawn group, which relates to this legislation that seems beneficial, would be the registration of an established recycling business and the requirement of receiving a valid ID from a seller and having them state via signature that they were the true owner of the item. The retention and the responsibility to produce such records to law enforcement when requested is not objectionable. After reflecting on my trip to the pawn shop, this system could not collect the relevant data, and it could cause a tremendous waste of time and money to both law enforcement and recyclers. The data collection of the names, which seems like the only thing that the system is capable of doing in our industry, is dangerous to the point of basically just becoming a profiling system. It's very possible that certain groups might take issue with the data collection as a profiling issue. The only reliable data retrieved and usable is the customers who frequent a legitimate business. I certainly see the need to work to achieving a balance of law enforcement needs, public safety, as well as the recycling industry, and I welcome any of the groups to ask for my assistance or any of my colleagues. I want to thank you all for letting me participate. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Leiter? Okay, Mr. Bell, would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andy Stabell. I am the president of Great Western Recycling, a metal recycling company here in St. Paul. Recyclers have always promoted recycling by making it convenient and beneficial to do. It helps the environment by keeping recyclables out of the landfills. It also provides an avenue for the business owners, such as bar owners, plumbers, electricians, as well as other legitimate individuals, to have an opportunity to receive payment for the for their metal goods. Recyclers are not the criminals here. This is in part about brazen theft, causing significant property damage and risk to innocent neighboring citizens. What is additionally criminal is that property owners and lending institutions are, pardon the expression, pawning off their responsibility onto government, law enforcement, and recyclers. They are responsible for protecting their assets. Why aren't they turning off the water and the gas on their buildings? Here are their valuable assets, and the owners of them should make every effort to protect them. Why are they not utilizing wireless and cellular security alert systems? These shuttered and non-occupied buildings have a potential to become a danger to others, as we have seen. Property owners need to be responsible in this matter. One illustration I brought with me is this is 1 month of individual transactions that we've done at our business of all the metal goods with individuals that bring them in. There's 16,000 transactions here, and that's a tremendous amount of data to feed up and to hold for any period of time. Each one of those lots would be required by this legislation to be held and set aside and waited on for a period of 5 to 10 days. and we can exclude some, and they've made some exclusions, but there still remains a significant amount of transactions that are required. So that's a big concern of ours. Another thing that was brought up at the previous hearing, as I wrote it down, was that there are approximately 400 houses in St. Paul that are vacant, and of which 25% had been stripped. Now that's a lot of problems and a lot of property damage. Now, of those 100 houses, there's roughly 100 pounds of scrap metal. That's 10,000 pounds have been stolen. Our business purchased 3.5 million pounds of those types of commodities over the last year. How do we find that needle in the haystack? We're here to help and support and find common ground and ways to do that. And to help.
And are there any questions for Mr. Stavell? All right, Senator Higgins, do you have any other information that you would like to share with us today?
Madam Chair, let me just go through a few of the items that I jotted down when Mr. Cassidy was speaking. Too much information collected was one of the things he said. If you look at the bottom of the A5 amendment, which is the bill before you, we're exempting out of this transactions involving pop cans, beverage containers, transactions involving the purchase of industrial scrap metal that is transported to the scrap
amendment,
dealer,
I
the A5 amendment, under the terms of a written contract. Transactions that are sold by people who can demonstrate that...
Before she goes on, we don't have the A5 amendment.
We just want to make sure we have the right piece in front of us.
You have the A5 amendment from the last hearing. It was put on in the last hearing.
All right. They have renamed it to the A1 because there was a typographical error, and it is now the A1 amendment.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify so that we're looking at the correct piece.
Okay. It's the same place. So the top of the bottom of the first page. So we're exempting out the Boy Scouts with their pop cans. We're exempting out transactions under the terms of a written contract. We're exempting out transactions that the seller can show it that producing scrap metal is a byproduct of their business, such as an aluminum siding contractor or a demo contractor, those kinds of people. Cars and the $75 or less transactions. I think that of that 16,000 transactions that Mr. Stabell had, we're going to get rid of almost all of those. We're going to get it down to the small stuff that comes in, and it's going to look like that. And at what is it, $3 a foot for copper these days, something like that, $2 a pound. Okay. So we have pared this down to what we think is the problem. I don't think that the businesses who come in every day and get rid of their scrap that they produce as part of their business, they're not the problem. So we've exempted them out. The idea that somebody could come over after there's an open criminal investigation and wander around the yard, it's gone then. And I dare say that it takes, more than, a day to open a criminal investigation and get everything together. We have police officers here. They can probably tell you about that. But I let me just tell you one thing. Trying to figure out where to go to wander around in a yard is a big part of the problem. I talked to you the last time I was here about the thefts of the little statues from Theodore Worth Park. They ended up over in Mr. Stabell's shop in St. Paul. So if the Minneapolis police were looking for those little statues, they would start in Minneapolis. And if his employee hadn't done the right thing and said, there's something funky here, we're not going to take these, maybe in their process of moving everything through so quickly, they'd have been gone. As it was, they rejected them, and they were able to contact the police and get it taken care of. But, where do you go to wander around through the yard anymore? That's why the APS system can be used, because it gets the information out statewide. Data privacy, that's the jurisdiction of judiciary. That'll be the next committee that we go to. Mr. Cassidy said the customers are law-abiding citizens. Yes, most of them are. But this is just like everything else we do around here when we start talking about, you know, passing laws for bad behavior. There are always a few bad actors that are the reasons why we pass the laws around here. And we've got some bad actors out there. And what this bill is trying to do is to shut off the spigot of the money to them. The holding period, I offered to take it down to 2 days. I got rid of the 10 days. I don't know why we're still talking about that. But I had it at 5. I offered to go to 2. And just let me call to your attention, if you would please, take a look at this. These are letters and emails from folks all over Minnesota talking about the epidemic proportions of theft of metal from work sites, from seasonal properties, from cabins. The sheriffs have weighed in. Andy Schreiner from Quest talks about there's been a dramatic increase in the theft of copper and supplies. While the economic harm to Quest is obvious, customer service is also impacted when materials and supplies aren't available. The materials and supplies at issue are critical to the providing service to Quest customers. The firefighters know, they have a letter in here too. They know that the scavengers are stripping properties and they are going into vacant homes. It's only a matter of time before some firefighter, a first responder, is killed going to one of these houses that fills up with gas and then goes boom. We've been lucky so far. We've had 4 buildings in my district that have gone boom because somebody was stupid enough to cut the gas lines. The house fills up with gas. It could be a little kid that sets it off. It could be who knows what. But it's dangerous, and we need to get it stopped. The Associated General Contractors are here. They're saying it's a reasonable and prudent approach to help alleviate the theft and the subsequent sale of high-value materials from their construction sites. They ask you to please pass this bill. We've got somebody here from the City of Burnsville Police Department. He says that he could go on and on and on forever, but it would take too long an email to talk about what's gone on in the City of Burnsville. Neil Peterson from Faribault lists 3 different companies. Michelle's Construction, a company that built 3 new electrical transmission lines from Faribault to Lakeville last year. They suffered at least 3 large thefts of wire. Minnesota Electric Supply in Faribault also experienced a large theft of wire from their business. The suspects cut a hole through the wall of the building to take the spools of wire out. McQuay of Faribault had suspects cut through a chain link fence to remove a large amount of tubing. It was recovered at a nearby scrapyard. Unfortunately, the tubing had been damaged beyond use. I can go on and on and on, but please spend a little time hearing from folks in your own districts about this. It's a serious issue, and you know this may not be the be all and end all, but it will move us forward. It will help shut off the spigot, and that is exactly what we need to do. I have other people here who can testify on behalf of the amendment, if you'd like.
Perhaps Mr. Cassidy expressed that he wanted to make another comment.
Madam Chair, members, I would just make a couple of observations on Senator Higgins' comments, and that is, I think as Mr. Stabell demonstrated in August of 2006, he had 16,000 metals transactions at his business. This bill, despite Senator Higgins' attempts to scale it back, would still cover over 8,000 of those transactions. That's a lot of information from one yard down on the Mississippi River in St. Paul. Second, the Theodore Worth statues are a perfect example of what's going on in the industry right now. The law enforcement community and scrapyards are communicating with one another. They're emailing each other. They're faxing each other information when they identify metal thefts, in particular large ones, and those yards are on the watch for them. And that's what happened with the Theodore Worth statues. That yard was on notice, and they caught the guy. Finally, I'll get back to the same thing, and in response to all the letters that have come in, there is a problem out there. But these property owners also, in these businesses, have to take responsibility to secure their yards. This is happening all over the place. A lot of them, especially the large ones, you have to ask yourself whether or not these are inside jobs by employees. I think there was an example last week of an Air Force base that someone mentioned, a $30,000 copper theft. So those are the things to consider. We are not opposed to doing a bill that has proper regulation, registration of our members, collecting the appropriate amount of information on our customers. We're not opposed to. We think there is a solution. We recognize that there is a huge problem and that we have to be a part of the solution. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Scheid. Senator Neville. Senator Scheid first, and then Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, thank you. Mr. Cassidy, so you think that there would be some information that you'd be willing to have gathered. I think I spoke to Senator Higgins. I think, you know, down to eye color is a little iffy because I don't think it may say something on a driver's license, but I was actually in the position a few years ago to be looking at a driver's license someone handed me and it was not them. And the reason I knew was because I was looking them in the eye and I looked, but I just can't imagine, you know, that you would expect an employee in a business like this to have to check people out that closely. I was suspicious of this person anyway, and so, you know, and I knew it wasn't, and the unfortunate thing was I had to give back a stolen driver's license to the customer, which really upset me. But,
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, you would just take that information right off the driver's license. That would be what it would be from.
Madam Chair, what I'm suggesting is it may not be their driver's license. And so, you know, I don't think you need to do that. But I like the idea of the license plate, and maybe, you know, a driver's license number is fine, and name. But I think that all of that is a little prescriptive, to say the least. I mean, make, model, color, and license number. I mean, I'd be hard pressed as an employee to do that or to be able to go out to the, you know, and check all that out. I just think license number is one thing, but everything else might not be necessary. I mean, I'd like to see you work with them because I think we need to do something about this, and I agree. You know, you can't have happening what is going on right now. And I guess I would ask Mr. Cassidy and the gentleman with you, what do you do when you get a brand-new roll of copper wire? Because I understand that's happening. Or what do you do when they come perfectly cut, you know, in 2-foot lengths or whatever? I mean, does that trigger a, you know, does a red flag pop up?
Madam Chair, Senator Scheid, I will let my client respond to part of that, but I can say that some things are pretty obvious. And especially when you see a bin of brand-new copper come in and it looks like it's been chopped off of a spool. I mean, they're in this business. They know. And they put their clients or their customers on notice right here in the sign, in fact, that anything suspicious, they'll be turned away. In response to your first question regarding the level of information to collect, there's a reasonable amount that we think we can agree to, and we already collect a lot of it. The reasonable amount needs to be enough so it deters people from criminals from showing up at our yard trying to transact business. That's where we think the appropriate amount. But there's a lot of things in here, height, weight, race, things like that feed into the pawn system or the automated pawn system that I think are things that we need to think about.
Okay. So if we might have this other testimony, and then Senator Neville, and then just as a point of information, we have a number of amendments here that we feel might be proposed. We're trying to get through three other bills. I've talked to Senator Metz, and we'd like to have some more work done on this bill and come back and discuss it at a later date. It sounds as if that you are talking, Mr. Cassidy, about you have some solutions, you'd like to work on the bill. I'm not sure we're going to get through all of these today. Anyway, so if we can perhaps just follow up with just a little bit more discussion and then continue working on it.
Madam Chair, if people have amendments, possibly they could see me about them.
That is my point, Senator Higgins, is that I would like to see, I think we would like to see more work done outside this committee if there's some compromise. I'm not sure that has happened yet, and I would highly encourage that to happen before we all come back and talk about this some more.
So, Madam Chair, you're not going to do any more work on it?
Not today.
Okay.
But we would like to follow up just to have Senator Neville, since we have another person here, to just have that a a bit more discussion, and then we would encourage, if Mr. Cassidy has some suggestions, to work with you.
We've talked and talked and talked, Madam Chair. We're a long ways away.
Okay, Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I wasn't here at the very beginning of your presentation, but is there any suggestion that the scrap metal dealers have actual knowledge when they take these materials that they're stolen? I mean, are you somehow claiming that they're complicit in the sale? Is that part of the reason you're being so prescriptive here?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, I would say the vast majority of scrapyard dealers are doing the best they can. If you look at the sign that's over there, they're telling people they're going to, you know, take driver's license and things. But that's not everybody. And we do know that, you know, sometimes individual employees aren't as good as the others. A week or 10 days ago, there was an article on the Channel 5 News that you can, I think, still see on their website where somebody, I think it was one of the St. Paul police officers, went to a scrapyard and tried to sell something that looked obviously stolen. And the employee resisted, I think, twice. And the third time he came back, he went, "Oh, all right." And, you know, so there are different levels in all of the different companies.
The reason I asked is that as I read through the bill for the first time today, it does seem to be overkill. And nobody denies that there's a problem. But if we believe that most scrap dealers are honest and legit and are seeking to catch the people who are selling stolen materials, you know, why couldn't we do something like an Amber Alert like we do for kids? And, you know, you're going to require them to download in this bill, at the end of the day, all the transactions to law enforcement, I guess, if I'm reading it right. Why couldn't you just have it come the other way? If law enforcement becomes aware that there's something stolen, why can't they send out an alert to all the scrap dealers who are on the list saying, "We're looking for such and such"? Do you have reason to believe that the scrap dealers are so dishonest they wouldn't be able to do that?
So we can just answer this question, and then we're going to end discussion on this topic. If you just sort of introduce yourself for the tape, please.
Sergeant Paul Ford, St. Paul Police. I investigate these crimes. Senator Metz and Senator Neville, a couple weeks ago we did a one of our investigators took a ladder from the St. Paul Police Department. It was broken. It was damaged. It was going to be thrown out. It had property of the City of St. Paul Police on it. We cut it up. Our investigator brought it to a scrapyard. They took it. Same day, another instance, same investigator had some cut-up copper piping packaged in a way that we see it when we recover it after it's been taken out of a house, brought it to a local scrapyard. They asked for ID. The officer said, "I don't have ID." And then they came back later after looking at it and said, "Well, we're not going to take that." And the investigator said, "How about if you give me half price for it?" And at that point, they agreed. And again, this was all videotaped by KSTP, and it was aired on their news, and we still have that video. So there are definitely some issues here that need to be resolved. I don't think self-regulation is as effective as the owners believe, and the owners obviously aren't the ones taking the scrap. They can't always control what their employees do. That's why a lot of these regulations would be extremely helpful.
We're going to end the discussion at this point in time and put this on the table for further discussion. And again, if people have amendments, perhaps talk to Senator Higgins about those prior to our next meeting. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can we just say one more thing?
Certainly, Senator Higgins.
I'm Tina McNamara. I'm the commander of the Investigative Division for the East District. And the question you asked about law enforcement sharing the information with scrapyard metals, we get information that we distribute between investigative divisions all over the state. It's a tri-county alert, police department to police department. The information that we receive, we cannot, under data privacy, share with them. And then when we do share it with them, it's something we'll get to them at a later date, to the scrapyards. We do have something that we can send out through the BCA on a crime alert. Several of the scrap card companies do accept it, We can't even get them to check IDs, let alone check their facts for the BCA crime alert. This is a huge problem. And when the companies are saying it's a needle in the haystack, I'm the needle in the haystack. I'm that life that's going to go in the door. This is a huge problem.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Better practices we can fix. It doesn't make sense at all. If they're stolen property, they can't put out any words. They're looking for X.
Senator Sparks, you have a employment training services initiative, Senate File 1358.
Well, I don't even know. I don't know eye colors. I don't know. Who are they?
We got committee members, three bills to go. And we got about 25 minutes, and I think we can do it. We don't want to come back tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It will be brief, obviously. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1358. And I think that I know when this committee was created this year, we were trying to look at ways we could do things better and more efficiently. And I think that the bill that we're going to bring forward you today for a pilot program for workforce development is something that would do exactly that. I do have a handout, Matt, if you'd like to come get this, we could do that. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers. They certainly are a lot more knowledgeable with me. Today I have Mr. Bob Haas, the site manager for the Austin Workforce Development, that had some of these ideas, and also Mr. Randy Johnson, the executive director for the Workforce Development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the Minnesota Senate. Thank
Randy
you.
Johnson, executive director of Workforce Development Incorporated. We're the job training provider in 10 counties of southeast Minnesota and also representing the Workforce Investment Board in that area. Done this kind of work here for about 20 years in that area, 10 years as a director prior to that in private business. I've noticed some changes here lately, and in our board that is put together of 33 members representing all of southeast Minnesota, and 20 of them are private business. The number one thing that we've been studying lately is the impending labor shortage. It's absolutely critical. It's critical for the whole state and the nation. In our area, we are projecting that the combination of the low birth rates of the native-born folks that we have, as well as the rapid escalation of retirement, is going to put us in a real pickle here for the numbers of people that we can employ in all industries. In studying our industries, we found that the number one and two areas in our area were industrial clusters, I should say, in our area were healthcare and manufacturing. Now, with that said, we've been our folks that come through our door, despite the fact we have a critical labor shortage, we get about 6,000 to 7,000 adults that do churn through our door in a year that are seeking help. Most of those come in two categories, one being a dislocated worker, someone who's lost their job. State of Minnesota, I think, has a pretty good system for dealing with that, combination of state and federal funds, which provides for retraining in case that's necessary and finding jobs for those folks. The other group, though, would be that group of people that are either welfare recipients, severely underemployed, or haven't been in the labor market. That's where things break down a bit from our estimation over the years here. We've grown a system that has become increasingly bureaucratic as to how to deal with folks, who, especially those that are welfare recipients, and the resources are diminishing. When someone comes in the door, they really need a job. They need resources. They need a way to move beyond. What we are able to give them in many cases is a lot of paperwork and a lot of running around the table. Much of that driven from a federal perspective. There is a requirement to track participation rates and a lot of other things that really are just tracking how busy a person is. And it consumes a lot of our time. I'm not sure that we're going to be able to fix that in the short run, but I think that there will be an opportunity, I hope, in the next few years to take another look at our welfare reform system. In the meantime, what we would like to do is demonstrate something that we've already been able to prove on a smaller scale to ourselves. Using some unique federal funds, we were able to put together an approach where we studied healthcare and said, how do we get people in here with skills? It's not enough to just herd them out the door and have them take the first job that they come to. Employers are telling us, please don't do that to us because the folks are not ready to work. We need to really document those skills that are necessary and work on them. We put together a concept of an academy where we were able to do that up front. and move them through. And bottom line on that brief process was that we were able to take a program of welfare reform, which does provide, by our measurement, a little over 800% return on investment. That's $8 return for every dollar invested, but move that even higher to $11.50 return for every dollar invested in that health care project. We would like to do the same thing here on a pilot basis to study the needs more specifically at the local level for manufacturing. And I think in this case we would be able to pull off a 1-2 punch here, being able to be more targeted and demand-driven with folks coming through the door to move them into, give them the opportunity to understand what the skill level needs are in manufacturing healthcare, our number one and two occupational clusters in our area, and do that in a pilot project that would be able to be replicated elsewhere within the state.
Chair?
Yes, welcome.
If I could, if Mr. Haas, I think, has got a good story, if you could just explain that briefly, I think it would really help to bring to light what could happen if this project was able to move forward.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Bob Haas. I'm the area manager for Workforce Development Incorporated, offices in Austin and in Albert Lea. We have offices in the Workforce Center. Part of the problem that I think we're facing in all the programs that we deal with is the programs don't talk to each other. They don't. The regulations are totally different, and we can't just take a disadvantaged individual and work with that individual. We have to look at the programs that they're involved in. And one of the difficulties that I've recently encountered, I'm working with a young lady now who. In Austin, who was laid off from her job through no fault of her own, and she was working at this job for 6 years. She got laid off. She became a dislocated worker. She received a good assessment and employment counseling, and she was enrolled in a medical assistant training program at Riverland Community College in Austin. She was about halfway through her program, and her unemployment ran out, and she had no other money to live on. She had three children, so she applied for welfare benefits. The welfare program then told her that she had to quit her school because the program that she came in under told her that she had to immediately go to work, and it didn't matter what training program she was in. This just isn't right. The system was telling her that she needed to take a $6.50 or $7 an hour job, when in fact, if she would have completed her medical training program, she could have gotten a job at the Austin Medical Center for $14 an hour with benefits, would have been able to support her three children as a single parent, and we would never see her. The current circumstances say that if she gets a job at $6.50 or $7 an hour with three children, she never will get off the welfare system. And we will see, and if she does, we'll see her back because she doesn't have appropriate training. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions of
Mr. Chair, just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sparks, great bill. Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Yeah, that sounds like a good program. It's going to find you some money. It's not asking for a lot of dough, though, either, is it?
How much? What's the appropriation?
$160,000 appropriation, Mr. Chair.
All right. We're going to move this on. And we got Senator Tomasoni in the building, so we're going to encourage him to like this one, too.
I would move, Mr. Chair, that Senate File 1358 be recommended, passed, and sent to Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Did you talk to the finance chair about all these things?
I'm going to at 5:30 this evening. Get the money where it belongs. In your division. No. All right. On the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Sir.
Hello, Welcome to the – well, you're on the committee. Yeah, you've been here all day, haven't you? Senator Rosen, Senate File 1303.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and fellow committee members. Senate File 1303 is a nanotechnology development fund for Minnesota small companies. And it's very exciting because we're talking nanotechnology, which is nanoscience. And I'm serious about this. This is the science of the very, very small. It's not. Mr. Chair, members, I was stuck in a snowstorm all weekend, and I read all this stuff about nanotechnology, so I'm on top of it. But
we're pretty bored, huh?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Just kidding. This is good stuff.
Well, it's in nanotechnology or nanoscience is not just a concept. It is truly, they are looking at it as the next industrial revolution. And they're saying that the National Science Foundation, the NSF, is saying that it could predict as a global market $1 trillion in the next 20 years. So it's definitely coming down the pipeline, and it's here in Minnesota. The National Science Foundation also refers to nanoscience as the manipulation and the control of matter at the nano level, which a nanometer is 1/1000th of a meter. So the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office also created a whole new registration category just for nano inventions. And truly, this is very exciting because this just fits right into what the state of Minnesota is doing. Nanoproducts are just not in the bioscience area, and my two testifiers will go into a little bit of that also. But I would like to just point out a letter that was sent by the Minnesota High Tech Association, which you should all have in your packets. And there's 300 members in this organization, and they're talking about this bill and how important it is to the small companies and this whole development of nanoscience or nanotechnology in the state. And we have positioned ourselves very well in the state for this development. Right now, many large companies are using nanotechnology, and they've been doing that for years. They can afford the very expensive equipment and instrumentation that's involved in this science of the very small. But the smaller companies are not. Thank you, Senator Bono.
Yes, I got it.
But the smaller companies are having a very tough time with their research and their products because this is very expensive equipment, and they have to rent it by the hour. So that there's delays in the development of the products, and it hinders the growth and the job creation. So what Senate File 1303 does, it creates a fund, the Nanotechnology Development Fund, the NDF, which would be administered by the DEED to develop a unique collaboration between the state, the private sector, and multiple academic institutions such as the U and several institutions of MinSCU, or locations of MinSCU. The fund would be for businesses under 50 employees, so we are talking small. And then this NDF fund, or the Nanotechnology Development Fund, would provide matching grants, and that's what's exciting about this bill. They'd provide these grants upon demonstration of corporate qualifying expenditures to assist small businesses with nano instrumentation and provide experienced research consultation. So there's a two-prong approach. Provide the instrumentation and provide the research to back it up. The Nanotechnology Development Fund would also provide the opportunity to influence Minnesota's future workforce through a merit-based internship program that would expand the number of researchers working with the nanotechnology application in medium to large companies, and that would also be a one-to-one match through the NDF fund. Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment I'd like to move, please.
Okay, does that have to be explained, or?
Basically, Mr. Chair, what it did was it took out in subdivision 3 on lines, starting on page 1, line 24, it takes out some of the qualifying language for these companies. And the reason is they're startup companies. They don't have a net worth yet, these small companies. They All right. have probably personal wealth.
That's good enough for me. Hi.
Yep.
Senator Rosen moves the amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Richard Baker.
thank you, Mr. We kind of, I don't like to do this, but can we kind of do this in about 5 minutes or so? Yeah. You guys, we're out of the room at 1:45, and we've got other meetings tonight. Otherwise, I've got to bring the committee back, and I don't want to do that. Okay. Thank you. Go ahead. Okay. Identify yourself for the tape, but did you wish to?
Can I do 1 minute?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Rich Baker. I am Vice President of Engineering at MTS, and I'm here representing MinNano as the Chairman of the Advocacy Committee. So I'll be very brief. MinNano is the group that has proposed some of this legislation, this bill. We're made up of companies that are on slide 3. We're the founding companies, and then I just want to point out that we're a diverse bunch of companies: Honeywell, Seagate, Integrus, Goodrich, Medtronic, MTS, Imation, and RJA Dispersions. So we're a group that sees the value of the technology that we're talking about here in nanotechnology, and it cuts across a wide range from medicine to materials and agriculture. Energy. There are a lot of areas. It's really a convergence of technology that's important to stay ahead on the R&D side. None of these companies are benefiting directly from the bill that we're proposing here, but we see the value in establishing a technology cluster as opposed to an industry cluster where we share ideas and we build an ecosystem around nanotechnology development. And I will leave it at that. I won't try to explain nanotechnology in 2 minutes.
No, we wouldn't understand it anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hare.
I wouldn't, I should say.
Hi, my name is Bob Hare, and I'm the CEO and a founder of Nanocopia, which is a nanotechnology company that focuses in the medical area, specifically on making nanoparticles and putting them on medical devices so that they can deliver drugs and other therapeutic benefits. I didn't know what a nanoparticle was 5 years ago either, but I discovered this technology at the U, and we formed a company around it. I'm one of those small company examples, 6 employees. We live and work in the former BCA building down on University Avenue, taking advantage of some old state infrastructure. And we found when we got started that we had to have access to a technology which was imaging, the ability to look at these tiny particles, which are much smaller than a red blood cell, on the surfaces of the things we were coating. And so I went to the university and to some private companies, and the quotes I was getting for an hourly rate were in the $300 to $600 an hour to access some of this equipment. We actually made that investment and got started, turned our first expenditures there into almost $1 million in federal funding from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. I've become trained and a user there. We use it many hours a week. We're now collaborating formally. We've been able to hire undergraduate students and train them and provide them with an industry link experience. So this is the kind of thing that can happen if you recommend and pass this bill. I think you'll see this kind of economic development happening. We're going to hire 2 more scientists this year, and I think this is what we ought to be doing. So thank you very much for the ability to be here.
Okay. Exciting stuff.
Yep.
A lot of good ideas around here.
Mr. Chair.
Need some money to do a few of them. Senator Rosen?
This is very exciting. What makes this unique is that there is matching funds from the businesses, from the industry itself, and that's very exciting to get this started. And we haven't talked about intellectual property. Minnesota's own intellectual property, which we want to keep here, and that's a whole other discussion, but it's very important. So,
well, thank you for bringing this forward. This is, see what happens. Thank you. we need a motion, I suppose.
I was wondering if you had any questions, but there are no.
Oh, look at their very friendly crowd today.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that Senate File 1303. Be recommended to pass and sent to finance the committee.
Okay, on the motion. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. I think on this last one, we're going to get it done, and I'm going to stay seated here. Senate File 1458. I think I'll bring up, I've got a script here, but the script was much better when it was explained to me in my office a couple of weeks ago. So I feel and the other
Mr.
folks.
Mr. Chairman, my name
again,
is
I hate to rush you, but probably 5-6 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, happy to be there.
Ready to get it done?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Phil Griffin. I'm representing Life Science Alley. I have with me Dale Walters.
This is exciting stuff, too. Not because it's my bill. Well, that's one
my
of
my constituent.
Oh, it's really exciting then. Okay, Phil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have two strikes and we're almost out.
That's good.
Thank you. Senate File 1458 that we're bringing before you today is an idea that we believe will help to seed companies and do job growth in Minnesota here. We are talking about bioscience commercialization incentives. This is a $5 million grant that would go to the Department of Economic Development for bioscience business development and commercialization grants. The idea is to set up a small group that will review these grants, and this would be a group with industry expertise, and allow them to seed money to help do what we are calling spin-off technologies. There are lots of companies, and Mr. Wallstrom can speak to this more definitively, that go through the process of developing something. It doesn't fit in with their business plan, and they shelf that technology. Our goal here is to try and get that off the shelf with these small grants. The good news is that once the state makes those small grants, we immediately have jobs developing and hopefully are contributing more to our economic development. Mr. Chairman, before I turn over to Mr. Wallstrom, we would like to have one amendment. I think Senate Council has that. But on line 1.20 to 1.21, we would like to strike the language that says only companies incorporated in Minnesota are eligible for a grant under this section. There will be a number of these companies that will be incorporated outside of the state of Minnesota, although they may have a large number of people located here, and we'd like to have that flexibility in the language.
Be in Delaware, wherever, and still work here, so I don't think it. Senator Bonnet moves the amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
We're going to talk a little bit about how these companies get it to the threshold here and why that maybe that okay. That's what we want to hear, too, and what you're going to do. Okay, thanks.
My name is Dale Wallstrom. I'm the CEO of the BioBusiness Alliance. I'm retired from Medtronic as of last fall. I'm going to forego the bulk of my presentation and go straight to the graph that I believe you have in front of you. It's a flow diagram, and just talk from that. This is the way the process works inside of small and large companies, both more or less. Each company is a little bit different, but it's basically the same, and that is that if you start on the far left-hand side, there is a bunch of seeds. Every year, a company will seed different ideas, and they'll seed many of them. Over the course of moving from left to right, they'll go through the process of basic research, concept assessment, risk mediation, and establishing market potential. That time frame will usually run from months to decades, and the cost is somewhere between $1 to $10 to $20 million to get it to the point of having an internal review process. At that point in time, all these seed ideas will come forward, and a very rigorous review will be undertaken to assess which ones should be funded to go forward into the next phase. And the smaller bar extending to the right of that of the center line is the establishment of a new business internal to the company. And there's a relatively small number of those. In fact, about 30% of the seeds actually make it to that point. The reason for that is that to take it from the point of proving a feasible market, to the point of creating jobs on the far right-hand side and having full market release, the cost is somewhere between $5 million and $1 billion, and the time frame is anywhere from 3 to 10 to 12 years, something in that time frame, depending on whether you're talking about a drug or a medical device or something like that. So obviously, companies, especially smaller companies, are not able to spend that much money and that much time to bring all those ideas to market. So what happens to the 70% or so of the good ideas that have proven market potential that are not commercialized by the company as they go back on the shelf? And then hopefully next year the company will magically find more money and they'll be able to take out their new seeds that have come forward plus the old one. The reality is that over the course of time, most of those good ideas die. They miss their market opportunity, they miss the window, and they are no longer financially viable. What we're trying to do with this bill is to provide a small incentive to the parent company to take those businesses that they're choosing not to commercialize that have proven market value via the process that Phil mentioned and spin them out and form a new company. The second incentive would go to the new company, which would be a basic payment for creation of jobs as a form. Great jobs, they would receive a grant yet to be determined up to some maximum amount as long as those jobs are here in the state of Minnesota. And that is the fundamental goal that we're trying to accomplish. The benefits to the state is we are looking for a relatively small amount of money, small payments. We don't want a large payment to go out to the company. We want just enough to make it financially attractive and cause them to go over the edge and make the decision to spin it out. So if it's a relatively small amount of money, but these companies, once they pass that internal review and they spin off into the creation of businesses, they actually begin creating jobs the next day. The day after they're funded or they reach that point, you begin to hire a management team. Within a year or two, you begin to hire production, engineering, all the other classes of jobs that go along with the formation of a large company, or of a growing company, rather. And that's really, in sake of time, I'll end it right there. And Mr. Chair, if there are any questions.
But a lot of the work in the bioscience development takes place, the way I understand it, at some larger companies, and they get it to the 50-yard line or the 80, and then for some reasons it's not working for them, but other smaller companies could pick it up. Is that kind of a simplified way to say what you just did?
Yes.
Got to talk like it's South St. Paul language.
I would hesitate to say, sir, that it's only large companies, because the reality is small companies have
small
a lot
companies,
really good
too,
ideas.
That could get it to that point, but probably can't afford to. So it works. Yeah, I could see it. It could work both ways. So, exactly. Okay.
Yep. Exactly.
Mr. Chair, question?
Yeah.
Thank you. And Mr. Griffin, either one of you could answer, but one of the concerns I have is that if we make the grant too small, that in fact, you know, there's a lot of hiccups that you have as a small startup. And so if we make it too small and then it turns out the parent company has to invest a little more than they had planned, I don't want that grant money to be wasted. Mm-hmm. And so I would hope that there's some real criteria and a commitment on behalf of the parent company before we give them that grant, commitment in time that could be identified that say they cannot accept that money unless they're willing to do something, you know, just to make sure that they give it the needed amount of time to get through some of those, you know, because for every small startup, we all know there's so many, you know, times during their process when they almost fail.
Have you thought that through?
Yes, and Senator Bonoff, first of all, the parent company, once they sign the agreement to spin off their intellectual property, their relationship more than likely will be terminated. And that's required by federal law. They have to, in order for them to meet the federal guidelines, they would need to sever any kind of ownership, or not totally, they could be a minority investor, but they would have to sever any kind of decision-making authority. So by doing this, it spins it off into the normal process of venture capital funding and other types of funding. And what makes this a special approach in our minds is that if you look at that graph, the risk mediation has taken place, and that makes this very attractive to traditional forms of leveraged funding that you can get from the private sector. And we have verified that.
Just has to be enough.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonhoff, I think the other thing we'd say is that the reason for having this task force in place is to give those people with some real experience in spinning out these kinds of companies the chance to look and evaluate who we're going to give the grants to before we spin them out, so they don't end up in that position where we waste the money.
Thank you.
I would think you're right. You'd have the right people on the so-called screening committee and could work. Yeah. All right. I think this is very interesting.
Need a motion?
Yeah, would you make the motion? Senator Rosen.
I would love to make the motion for Senate File 1458 to be recommended to pass and move to the
full
Committee
finance.
On Full Finance. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. I think
Chairman
our
members, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank
I think our
much,
work
Chairman.
Is done for the day. Good work, committee members. We will not have to come back this evening. Well, some of us do for something else, but that's another story. With that, the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee closed for the day.